I'll tell you something funny about this collection. The first title was Too Jewish.
Oh my goodness, really?
Don't you think the stories are really too Jewish?
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Haley Cohen Gilliland, author of A Flower Traveled in My Blood, the incredible true story of the grandmothers in Argentina who fought to find a stolen generation of children. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Boy, a lot has happened in the last week or so in Iran and Israel, hasn't it? It's challenging to keep up with the news from Middle East and Washington to try to make sense of what may turn out to have been a pretty short war, or more accurately, a short episode in the much, much longer war between the murderous Islamist Iranian regime and Western civilization that is unlikely to end quite as quickly as some people in power seem to believe. Of course, last week the U.S. finally jumped into the Israel-Iran conflict directly, striking the Iranian nuclear weapons facilities with bunker-busting bombs and Tomahawk missiles. This followed Israel's devastating attack on a series of Iranian targets that severely damaged Persia's nuclear weapons program and took out the leadership of its military and terrorists and nuclear weapons institutions, and demonstrated Israel had complete control of Iranian airspace. However, it didn't stop Iranian ballistic missiles from striking Israeli civilian apartment buildings, homes, and hospitals. Almost immediately after the American strikes on Iran, President Trump proclaimed, prior to any military analysis of the impact of the attack, that Iran's nuclear program had been obliterated or wiped out. He also declared a ceasefire and pushed Iran and Israel to agree to it. Interesting. And now, apparently, the U.S. is going to be meeting with Iran while simultaneously trying to get more Arab countries to join the Abraham Accords and recognize Israel and open diplomatic and other ties. Of course, these same Arab countries that were petrified about Iran's military might and wanted Israel as a counterweight may no longer be quite as concerned about the Islamic Republic's strength after its nearly no-show performance in this war against Israel. Saudi Arabia and others might not feel the need to jump into an agreement with Israel right after they publicly decried its successful attacks on Iran, all while privately helping it. It's tricky. Wow. That's a lot for an American to keep in her or his head all at once, isn't it? You know, whenever I've been in Israel, close to 20 trips there, and I've lived there twice, once for a year, I'm always impressed by the fact that everybody who has an educated opinion about the Middle East, which means everyone there, always says at some point, it's complicated. Man, it is. And with the pace of developments now moving at high-intensity warp speed, it's nearly impossible to see where it's all heading, if anywhere in particular. So here are a few observations from a not-politically-trained rabbinical observer. Take them for what they're worth, knowing the source. First, Israel is in an almost incredibly better position in terms of security and strategic positioning compared to where it was October 8th, let's say, of 2023, while Hamas terrorists were still murdering Israelis in southern Israel and carrying more hostages off into Gaza. To refresh all of our memories, at that point, Israel's security services and military had been surprised by Palestinian terrorists and had just allowed the worst atrocities to be perpetrated against Jews since World War II. Israel's sovereignty and survival were threatened. Israelis were forced into bomb shelters throughout the country, south and north. 250 hostages were being held under Gaza in tunnels by Hamas Palestinian terrorists. In addition, It's important to understand this. In the fall of 2023, Israel was surrounded by a terrorist ring of fire funded and coordinated by Iran and its Islamist Ayatollah-led regime. Hezbollah in Lebanon was firing rockets regularly at northern Israel, a great deal of which had been evacuated. It was considered a far more dangerous enemy than Hamas in Gaza. Had tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands more rockets and a much more sophisticated military organization. The authoritarian dictator Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria had Iranian units located on the Syrian side of the Golan Heights threatening and attacking Israelis, funneling rockets and many other munitions to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Houthis in Yemen even began firing rockets at Israel from far to the south. And above all, Iran threatened every day to annihilate the Jewish state and murderously commit genocide against all its Jewish citizens. Iran was working rapidly towards developing nuclear weapons, according to everyone responsible, and doing so in facilities that were sophisticated, hard sometimes to even find, without even considering the international support that Hamas Palestinian terrorists were receiving for committing war crime atrocities, ranging from murder to arson to torture to mass rape, and the anti-Semitic wave of protests that immediately sprung up around the world. Israel itself was apparently in a terrible strategic position, perhaps the worst the country had been in since the intifadas of the early 2000s and late 80s, or even the Yom Kippur War back in 1973. Well, it's a little less than a year and 9 months since that time, considerably less than 2 years. A lot has happened. While Hamas retains some level of operational terrorist control over what's left of Gaza, all its senior leadership is dead. Most of its terrorist fighters are dead. Its ability to rain rockets down on Israel is gone, and it has helped turn its own homeland into a wasteland. Hezbollah in Lebanon has been not only decapitated, but nearly destroyed by Israel's shockingly effective Mossad and IDF-led campaign. Hezbollah may return as a serious threat, but primarily it's licking its wounds and trying to figure out how to keep control over its own part of southern Lebanon now. The brutal Assad regime in Syria collapsed after half a century in power, and the new government there is intent on expelling all Iranian influence, ending the flow of Iranian terrorism and munitions through Syria. And Iran itself has now been pounded and shocked. Its senior leaders, with the exception of the horrible Ayatollah, are all dead. Its nuclear weapons program has been set back dramatically. If I were the Houthis in Yemen, I'd be worried. As of now, and boy, things can change so quickly, Israel is the dominant military and intelligence power in the Middle East, and there's no close second, even though there are far richer and far larger nations all around it, many of them. Israel is winning all these wars on the battlefield, some hard fought at a high cost, like Gaza, others quickly and stunningly. But that, of course, is not the whole story. It's complicated, remember? The second salient point to recall is that Israel is losing the public relations battle around the world, badly. While very few protesters said much about the collapse of Hezbollah or the Assad regime, somehow the same protesters who seek a free Palestine from the river to the sea now are supporting the horrific Islamist regime in Iran, which has been chanting for the destruction of America and the West for 45 years. That same Iranian regime, the Ayatollah and so on, in slightly different forms, has also been trying to destroy everything it hates about Western values everywhere else for 4.5 decades. It seeks to wipe out democracy, free speech, equality for women, the right to protest or assemble, a free press, everything intrinsic to a free society. In Iran itself, the Islamist leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran are widely hated and deeply feared. The mullahs, particularly the Ayatollah, are not popular in Persia. Their economy, in spite of huge oil reserves and a giant oil industry, and very sophisticated educational system, their economy is a disaster. The Iranian regime's leaders have murdered many of their own citizens, tortured their own citizens, imprisoned their own citizens, brutally suppressed all dissent and protest. And of course, the terrorists they fund around the world have murdered people in many countries. So, watching huge crowds assemble to protest against U.S. action against Iran, and holding virulently anti-Semitic signs at times, supporting this horrific Iranian regime, seeing those crowds in London, New York, Paris, Athens, Los Angeles, Tokyo, Sydney, the Netherlands, it's disturbing. Apparently, people have a very hard time understanding that this Iranian Islamist Ayatollah regime is simply evil. It perpetrates evil on its own people. It exports evil all around the world. Its close allies are Russia, North Korea, and China, authoritarian regimes that share weapons and perhaps torture techniques with Iran. And now, in the streets of American cities, and when the kids go back to college, we'll see it on campuses too, protesters wave Iranian Islamic Republic flags, chant anti-American slogans, and associate all of it with Israel and Jews, whom they apparently hate. And these brave protesters see the Palestinians and Iranians as similar victims of evil Western colonialism, which they are not, of course, but good luck convincing the protesters otherwise. In other words, Israel is winning wars, but stands a pretty good chance of losing much, if not even most, of the public. Look, I don't have full solutions for any of this. Nobody does. On balance, it's better to win the war and lose the PR campaign, right? But we must be cognizant of both. In our contemporary world of instant information and instant disinformation, I think we are now close to the time when Israel, having thoroughly defeated its most implacable enemies, moves to establish actual peace. I certainly hope so. On a positive note, and to play us in this morning, reflecting the long and mostly positive history of Jews in Persia and Iran, 2,500 years at least, most of it prior to this Islamist revolution 45 years ago, here is Persian Jewish Israeli singer Hadar Maoz singing her own creative rendition of Psalm 150. Hallelujah. That was Iranian-Israeli singer Hadar Maoz singing Hallelujah. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Haley Cohen Gilliland, author of an extraordinary new book, A Flower Traveled in My Blood, the incredible true story of the grandmothers in Argentina who fought to find a stolen generation of children. Meet Haley when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Haley Cohen Gilliland is a journalist, director of the Yale Journalism Initiative. She has written for a number of prominent publications. Her new book is called A Flower Traveled in My Blood, the incredible true story of the grandmothers who fought to find a stolen generation of children in Argentina. It's a powerful and carefully researched and beautifully written book. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about the genesis of the book.
I moved to Argentina in 2011, shortly after graduating college. And I moved down with a basic working knowledge of what had happened during the dictatorship. I knew that the military had disappeared thousands of Argentines. But it wasn't really until I arrived in the country and began to live there that I learned the full extent of the brutality. And the most shocking thing I learned was that among the thousands of people disappeared during the period of 1976 to 1983 were hundreds of women who happened to be pregnant at the time of their abduction. And these women were largely held in clandestine detention centers until they gave birth and then separated from their infants and quietly killed. And their infants were gifted to other families to raise, mostly families related to the armed forces, so police officers and military officers. And I was absolutely shocked to learn that this had happened, that this had happened so recently, and I hadn't known about it. And then I became completely obsessed with this group of women, the Abuelas de Plaza Mayo, who were mothers of the disappeared and grandmothers of those stolen infants who banded together to try to search for them at immense risk to themselves. And so I went down, you know, a rabbit hole researching everything that I could about these women and found that there was only one book that had been written on them in English. And it was a great book. I really enjoyed it, but it was more of an academic treatment. And I have always been most drawn to narrative histories, like those that Patrick Brown Keith writes or Eric Larson or Lawrence Bright, who you recently had on the podcast. And that didn't really exist. And at the time I was 22, so I didn't really think to write one myself. But I ended up living in Argentina for 4 years, and the Abuelas story always stuck with me. And years later, after the story had been kind of latent for me, I talked to a friend about it and realized that there were very few people outside of Argentina that knew about the Abuelas and that I could, you know, add value by just translating their story and bringing it to a new audience. And so that book that I'd once really wanted to read, I really wanted to write.
Boy, it's a powerful, and as you said, I knew a lot about the desaparecidos and how horrible the junta was. I'd never heard this story at all. And it has overtones of Nazi race management and boy, it's crazy stuff. But it's all true and very powerful. We will talk much more with Haley Cohen Gilliland when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established 6.5 years ago by congregants, and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious School is registering school-age children and grandchildren. Join us for Hebrew School, Barn Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night, Saturday morning. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m. Shabbat morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with services at 10 a.m. All with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. All of our services are on our Facebook page. It's Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and our rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, including Adult Bar and Bat Mitzvah class beginning in August, all taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona, Beit Simcha. My friends, if you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. All of those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Iran is obviously everywhere in the news now with the Israel-Iran war, the American attack. It's fascinating how many people now are suddenly experts about Iran. But the Iranian-Jewish relationship was throughout history, frankly, mostly positive and went back a very long time. You know a lot about that.
Well, I have a lot to say about all the subjects you just mentioned, but I'll start with my visit to Iran while the Shah was still on the peacock throne in the early 70s, long before the revolution, long before there was such a thing in Islam as an Islamic Republic. And the highlight of that trip for me, and really one of the most unforgettable Friday night dinners of my life, was when I visited Shiraz, which is a major Irani city, also a very major Jewish community that goes back thousands of years, literally. And it's the gateway to Persepolis for people who want to visit the ancient capital or the ruins of the ancient capital of the Persian Empire. So I went to synagogue on a Friday night, hoping that somebody would invite me home, little dreaming that the person who invited me home was the rabbi. And he, like many Irani Jews of the period, spoke French and a little bit of Hebrew, but my Hebrew was way better than his. In French, we were sort of on a par, and we did just fine. And during the evening at his home, I discovered a lot of distinctly Persian Jewish customs and foods and different ways of welcoming the Shabbat. And also, I learned that this guy was like, I don't remember how many generations, but like 60 or 70 generations of rabbis going back to at least 500 before the Common Era. So, you know, we think of an old rabbinic family as one that's three or four generations old. This guy's family was like, I don't know, 70 generations old.
Wow.
Pretty amazing.
So, you know, the Jewish life in Iran goes back to First Temple times. And really, Cyrus of Persia is the only guy called a Mashiach, an anointed one, who is not a priest or a king or something of Israel,
right?
Because he allows the Jews to return. So there was a positive relationship with the ancient Persians. And,
right.
And frankly, up until the fall of the Shah, the Jewish community in Iran was large and entrenched and I think well established.
And very prosperous.
Yeah, very prosperous. And in many ways, you know, productive, positive. Obviously, that changed very dramatically. I can tell you a little story. I went off to UCLA and my parents took in an Iranian Jewish refugee in the late 70s after the fall of the Shah, who later on went on to become a doctor. But it was, you know, Jews were trying to get out of Iran. There still are some Jews in Iran now, right?
Yep. So, I mean, they're not, most of them are not out of the closet. They live very discreet, careful lives. But there's somewhere between 10 and 20,000 Jews there. It's not, by far, not the tiniest Jewish community in the world, not the tiniest Jewish community in a Muslim country either. But they are careful, discreet, and very low profile.
I actually saw something where they were praying for the success of the current regime. Now, I don't know if that was Iranian propaganda. It's sort of hard to tell, but it was shot in a synagogue. So I think that's probably to keep themselves alive and healthy.
Right. I'm sure that so that synagogues can continue operating. Part of the bargain they made with the government, I'm sure, was the equivalent to our prayer for our country.
Right.
Which is kind of lip service. Nobody really thinks about the content, but it's there. And pretty much every country I've been in has an equivalent to that.
Such interesting times. As I said in a sermon last week, one of the famous Chinese curses, may you live in interesting times. We live in interesting times. Tom, we will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two Jewish guys are sitting in a deli, talking amongst themselves in Yiddish. An obviously Chinese waiter comes up and in fluent and impeccable Yiddish asks them if everything's okay. Can he get them anything else? The Jewish guys are dumbfounded. My goodness, where did he learn such perfect Yiddish? They ask each other. When they pay the bill, they call the deli owner over and say, where did your Chinese waiter learn such fabulous Yiddish? The owner leans in so nobody else can hear and says, Sha, he thinks we're teaching him English. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Very old. Special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. This week in the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, we read the odd ritualistic Torah portion of Chukat, the rites of the red heifer. In order to achieve ritual purity, ancient Jews were required to find a completely unblemished young red female cow, slaughter it, burn it to ashes, mix the ashes with water, and create a water of purification in which to wash away ritual impurity. While many elements of the sacrificial code of our ancestors seem odd or alien, this could be the strangest of all the strange rituals. It turns out that the red heifer, the Para Aduma, makes the person who is washed in its ash water pure, but it makes everybody else who comes into contact with it impure. The mystery is rather complete. Commentators have struggled with the meaning ever since the time the Torah was given. Just what is it that makes the red heifer the right animal to bring purity to the people? Why does it make you pure if you use it properly, but impure when you prepare it? The classic answer is that God ordains the use of a red heifer as a symbolic reversal of the episode of the golden calf. If the people sinned by praying to an idol of a calf, then the very real slaughter and burning of an actual cow and the use of its ashes might well atone for that transgression. But why should the process of making something that cleanses us ritually turn us unclean? Perhaps the answer is also symbolic. This process of bringing holiness to the world is never an easy one. Working in the field of holiness creation isn't simple. When you toil in the vineyards of the Lord, there's a tendency for the muck that exists in the world to attach itself to you. When we seek to bring purity into the lives of others, we stand a good chance of exchanging some of our own sanctity for a bit of the grime that stubbornly persists in most people's existence. The complex reversal of holiness in a sacred cow like the red heifer symbolizes the way in which we can only bring sanctity and purity at a price. When we acknowledge that price, accept it, and learn to cleanse ourselves ritually afterwards, symbolically or otherwise, we can replenish our ability to help and heal others. When we return on Two Jewish in a moment, our guest, Haley Cohen Gilliland, shares the aspects of the incredible story of how abuelas, grandmothers, found the children of their disappeared daughters and sons who had been stolen by the Argentinian fascist regime through a combination of incredible courage, persistence, and modern genetic technology. Hear more about this amazing story when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Okay, you've heard plenty about the Iran-Israel war and the U.S. involvement in it earlier in the show. We won't ignore that, surely, but, you know, there are other stories. Last week, President Donald Trump of the United States took the virtually unprecedented step of encouraging the Israeli judicial system to stop prosecuting Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, on his several corruption cases. Trump's social media post condemned the trial as a witch hunt, and his vow that the United States will be the one who saves Netanyahu from serious corruption charges came just 2 days, a little suspicious, after Trump forced Israel to call off a bombing raid on Iran. The jets were already in the air. They had to turn around to preserve a ceasefire that he himself had publicly declared. With all due respect to Trump, opposition leader in Israel Yair Lapid said, he is not supposed to interfere in a legal process in an independent country. Netanyahu himself said in a post addressed to Trump, he was deeply moved by your heartfelt support for me and your incredible support for Israel and the Jewish people. Bibi Netanyahu became the only sitting prime minister in Israeli history to be indicted when he was charged with fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three separate cases after years-long investigations accused him of exchanging favors with wealthy political supporters. Frankly, Netanyahu's corruption pales in comparison to, say, old Trump's corruption. Bibi is nowhere near as crooked as Donald. But Israel has strict rules about corruption among public officials, unlike perhaps the U.S. Bibi took the witness stand for the first time late last year. His own cross-examination began earlier this month, but several hearings have been postponed as he, as prime minister, dealt with the wars stemming from Hamas's Palestinian terrorists' October 7, 2023 horrific war crimes attacks out of the Gaza Strip. And now, our U.S. president is trying to insert himself into the judicial process of a free and independent nation that has the actual rule of law.
I need help, ladies and gentlemen. I need someone to stand beside me. I need someone to set a pit for me at the free throw line of life. Someone I can pass to. Someone to hit the open man on to give him go and not end up in the popcorn machine. So chill it.
In happier news, the New Jersey Nets NBA basketball team did something absolutely unprecedented last week. They selected not one, but two Jewish players in the draft, back to back. There are some Jewish players currently in the NBA. There have been teams with as many as two Jewish players in recent memory. Jordan Farmar and Omri Caspi were both on the Sacramento Kings about, 8 years ago. But this marks the first time two Jewish players were drafted by the same team since the advent of the NBA draft. Danny Saraf, a 6'6" point guard from Israel and the German Bundesliga, was picked number 26th in the first round of the draft. And immediately thereafter, less than 5 minutes later, the Brooklyn Nets also chose Danny Wolf, the 7-foot center from the University of Michigan. In Brooklyn, which has, of course, many Jewish fans, Saraf and Wolf will be the first Jewish NBA tandem since 2017. They are also the second pair of teammates in NBA history to hold Israeli citizenship. Wolf, who grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, acquired his citizenship in 2024 in order to play for Israel's under-age 20 team. The selection of two Jewish players completes a reversal of sorts for the Nets. Back in 2022, they were embroiled in an anti-Semitism scandal. Star point guard Kyrie Irving of the Nets in those days posted a link to a film that denied the Holocaust, as reported here on Too Jewish. Irving also blamed the Jewish people for slavery and accused them of usurping Jewish identity from black people. Kyrie Irving refused to apologize for days, ultimately leading the NBA to suspend him. The franchise traded him away in February of 2023 and, started over. The Nets' franchise selection of Wolf was the fifth they had in the first round of the draft, the most one team has ever made. Danny Saraf was born to parents who both played professional basketball in Israel. He grew up roughly 18 miles northeast of Tel Aviv in the village called Gan Yoshia. Saraf started playing organized basketball at age 8. Recognizing his talents, his parents hired a personal trainer and strength coach not long afterwards to accelerate his development. Danny Wolf's story is quite different. Raised in the Chicago suburbs, he went to a Solomon Schechter Jewish day school. That's a conservative one. His family kept a kosher home. He celebrated his bar mitzvah in Israel, later became an Israeli citizen, as you heard. He led the under-20 national team in Israel in points and rebounds when they won the silver medal in the 2024 European Championships. After transferring from Yale, he went on to become a big star at Michigan, leading them through the NCAA tournament. Wolf has been open about his Judaism. The most beautiful thing about Judaism, he said earlier this year, is the way it connects me with my family. It transcends other things, brings us together. Danny Wolf, who is 21 years old, told past two Jewish guests, journalist Mitch Albom, about his experience as a college athlete after the Hamas-led attacks of October 7, 2023, which happened when he was still at Yale. Now that I'm on a national stage and in the spotlight, you have ill-minded people that have some not great things to say, Wolf said. In a game against Dartmouth, Wolf said, more than 80 fans who came to the game disguised revealed Palestinian flags shortly after the game started. He said he learned to push through those incidents. It may be corny, but I'm just trying to be the bigger person, Wolf said. Nothing I can do in the moment will be good for me. Anything I say won't impact me or them, and it might cause more harm than good. Honestly, even with non-Jewish hate, there's a lot of it out in the world. I'd like to use it as motivation just to try and prove myself right and other people wrong. Well, we wish both of the Nets' Jewish draft picks, first-round draft picks, mazel, luck. Danny Saraf wears number 77, by the way, because in Gematria and Talmudic numerology, it adds up to the equivalent of mazel. And mazel tov. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Haley Cohen-Gilland has written an extraordinarily powerful and I think valuable book, A Flower Traveled in My Blood, The Incredible True Story of the Grandmothers Who Fought to Find a Stolen Generation of Children in Argentina. In putting together this book, the research you did, the photographs, the whole sort of way that you lay out the story, it's narrative history. But occasionally narrative history gets a little bit away from the facts. You never do that. Tell us about that balance.
Yeah. So I began my career as a fact checker. I worked for the Pulitzer Prize winning author Steve Call on his book, Private Empire. And that was such a formative experience for me for so many reasons. That was really my first glimpse into the process of crafting narrative nonfiction, especially at book length. And it really inspired me to want to do this work. And it also just instilled in me a fierce allegiance to facts. And it was really powerful training. I was trained for that job by someone from the New Yorker's fact-checking department, which is sort of the most vaunted fact-checking department in the magazine world. And in the course of this project, it was very, very, very important to me to stay faithful to the facts, because also there was just no reason to divert away from the facts, because the facts were so amazing. I wouldn't have needed to. You know, just telling the story as it happened felt like more than enough. But I was really privileged. I was very, very careful about fact checking myself. And then I did work with several external fact checkers who made sure that I hadn't missed anything and kept me accountable. So that was, I'm really glad that you asked that question, because fact checking for me was such an important part of this
process. Boy, I think we need a little more fact-checking in the world right now. It's going the other way. In researching this, of course, the tremendous pain of the loss of children, but there's a scientific aspect to this in terms of tracing down the descendants. These people, these children were taken away just after birth, their mothers murdered, and then placed in, as you know, allies of the fascist regime, military families who couldn't have kids, I assume, members of the government, loyal business people, whomever. How did they go about doing that? How did they unpack that undoubtedly well-hidden set of secrets?
Yeah, that to me was one of the most incredible aspects of this story, and one of the things that I felt hadn't been covered in the depth that it deserved, Ebola's trailblazing genetic work. So early on in their work together, the Ebola's realized that they were going to need something more than subjective evidence of their connection to their stolen grandchildren. Some of their grandchildren had been stolen when they were young children, and so they had photos of them. Maybe they had their baby teeth or locks of hair and things like that, or grainy photographs. But many of the abuelas were looking for grandchildren who were still in the womb when they were taken. They were still in utero,
right? Yeah, they weren't born, right?
Yeah, they weren't born yet. And so the abuelas had no idea what they were looking for. They didn't know if their grandchildren were male or female. They didn't know if they had an identifying birthmark, anything of the sort. And so to their credit, they realized that they needed proof. They needed a way to identify their grandchildren, both to find them and then to convince the court of those biological connections. And so they traveled the world using donations and pooling together whatever money of their own they could, and talked to every scientist that they possibly could badger into meeting with them to ask whether there was a way to use their blood to connect themselves to their stolen grandchildren. And at this point, DNA testing is not yet widely available. Paternity testing was available, but it wasn't as wasn't as accurate as it is today. And so they largely met with a lot of shrugs when they would ask this question around the world, until they met a renowned American geneticist named Mary Claire King, who would later become very widely known for discovering the BRCA1 gene, which predicts breast cancer. And together, working with Dr. King, the abuelas were able to pioneer completely new forms of genetic testing that allowed them to prove their link to their stolen grandchildren. And that to me really was one of the most incredible keys in this story, the fact that they had the prescience and the persistence to make that.
Without, being a spoiler here, it is extraordinary that some of them do get reunited. Tell us a little bit about some of those stories.
Yes. So the grandmothers are now in their 80s, 90s, and 100s, but they have never stopped searching for their stolen grandchildren. This is a story of history, but it is also very much an ongoing story. And thus far, the abuelas have managed to identify and reclaim 139 of an approximate 500 children who were stolen during the dictatorship. And one thing that was really, really interesting to me, and I explore this in the book, but many reunions, especially when the abuelas found not minors, so legal adults, their grandchildren had already turned 18, those reunions could be very fraught because these children had grown up largely with parents who were military officers, police officers, and they had been inculcated with those ideologies. And sometimes it took a long time for them to truly accept their real identities and their biological family. But one thing that was really interesting to me was that in pretty much every case I studied, with rare exceptions, ultimately those located grandchildren did accept their true identities, embrace the abuelas, and in many cases take on the mantle of their fight and their quest to find the remaining grandchildren. So that was something that was very interesting for me to see.
These women had to have extraordinary courage to face down a regime that had done these horrific atrocities. What impressed you about these women most?
That is a very difficult question because there are so many things. Their courage, as you mentioned, it's their relentlessness. And, the combination of those two things really did allow them to make genetic history in the way that we talked about. Dr. King used their work together as sort of the genesis of genetic genealogy as we know it, which is now a very widely used practice among law enforcement agencies and family heritage companies like Ancestry.com. They also they had the prescience and courage to document their work at a time when doing so was incredibly risky. And for me, this was very meaningful because it allowed me to to tell their story with much more vividness than I otherwise would have been able to. But basically, the dictatorship ordered that all of its own records related to the disappearances be destroyed when democracy was destroyed in Argentina. And the Abuelas archives that they had very meticulously gathered over years of work survived.
The Abuelas, who are, as you said, relentless, but certainly didn't know much about genetic testing, like becoming scientific experts so that they can find their grandchildren. Tell us about that a little bit. It's really amazing.
Yeah, it truly is. I mean, they fashion themselves into expert, legal experts, investigative experts, genetic experts, any skill that they needed to learn in service of finding their grandchildren. They really threw themselves into that work. As you mentioned, there were a couple of abuelas that did have medical backgrounds, for instance, but many of the abuelas had given up their careers when they had children. This was 1970s Argentina, and so traditional gender roles really reigned supreme at that time. Some of the abuelas were maybe school teachers, but they largely didn't have scientific experience, didn't have political experience, didn't have investigative experience. And in service of finding their grandchildren, they really did turn themselves into experts in all of these areas. And they were really dogged in tracking down experts to help them and to making sure that those experts continued to help them. Dr. King is very funny on this point. She was one of the sources that I was lucky to spend the most time with. And she talked about how upon finding a grandchild, the abuelas would pause to celebrate for maybe 10 minutes, and they would buy bottles of champagne and gather in the headquarters and sing glasses, and then immediately was back to work because their refrain was, there's always more grandchildren to be found. There's almost always more work to be done. And so they really never stopped. And they made sure that they gathered a wide circle of experts that they insisted on helping them. They weren't going to take no for an answer.
I want to thank Haley Cohen Gilliland for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about A Flower Traveled in My Blood and to find out more about you?
A Flower Traveled in My Blood will be available anywhere books are sold. I would encourage you to check it out from an independent bookstore if possible. Hopefully it'll be stocked in local libraries as well. And I have a personal website, which is hcgilliland.com. And I just want to thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Jane Loeb Rubin, author of the new novel in her trilogy about Jewish medical professionals in the era of World War I, Over There. And join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat, always delicious, always homemade challah, are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, in person and available on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning is from Cantor David Dudu Fisher, Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand lose its cunning. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good 4th of July this coming week, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
תשכח ימיני, תדבק לשוני, אוי לחיקי, אם לא אזכרכי.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.